listener production.
Shares.
Market.
The S&P.
The ASX.
Stocks.
This is Motley Fool Money.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, the podcast that is, well, at least a little bit geopolitically safer than the rest of the world. In saying that, here's Andrew Page from strawman.com. How are you, buddy?
Are you saying that I'm a threat to geopolitical stability?
I'm letting our listeners draw whatever conclusions they feel free to draw. I'm, of course, Scott Phillips from The Motley Fool, and we are the guys who bring you The Motley Fool Money podcast a couple of times every single week. Andrew is the founder and managing director of strawman.com, which apparently I've heard on the grapevine is a private investment club, mate. Is that about right?
You've heard correct.
There you go. I pay attention, see?
You thought
I was just whistling Dixie. I'm actually paying attention. They reckon repetition is the way you get messages through. So if that is true, that message has well and truly got through to our listeners. And of course, The Motley Fool provides, you know, independent financial advice. So if you want some stock recommendations, come and see us. If you want to join a great community of like-minded investors, go and check out strawman.com, or preferably do both. The finance industry is big. We are kind of half quasi-competitors, kind of, but the reality is there are so many bad guys out there. If you're going to spend money joining two different investment communities, different investment services, I would humbly suggest, with absolute bias, but also absolute conviction, that The Motley Fool and Strawman are two of the very best out there. So let's go with that. Absolutely. Mate, I'll tell you what, 2022, hey, I'm only pleased that having had 2021, when we, end of 2020, we said, I hope 2021's better. Good riddance 2020. This time around, no one was really, I didn't see a single person ever. Social media, traditional media, friends, family, no one said, good riddance 2021, 2022 is going to be so much better. We all kind of went, oh man, the third year of this crap. Okay, fair enough. And so that's kind of how the year started, and probably just as well, because it's been a hell of a ride, share market wise. You had a stat you found recently, apparently.
Yeah, apparently, at least this is true of the US market. I haven't done the stats on the Aussie market, but it's the worst start to the year on record for the S&P 500. Yeah, yeah.
It's not been pretty. Our market's not doing all that much better, even if it is. I actually did some stats the other day, which I'll drag up in real time, because I should have done this already and I didn't, and I should bring it up. It's, you know what's funny, how people, you've talked a lot of times, I think we even said last week about, you know, the whole trip around the sun means literally nothing. So the fact that we're in exactly the same solar place as we were 365 days ago literally means nothing, other than we kind of find a point and a time and a place to mark something. And look, measuring performance does matter. So, you know, we're not of the school thought saying, well, who cares, don't worry, it doesn't matter, all that kind of stuff. We are literally saying, hey, here's where we find ourselves, and it's worth checking in. But here, can I share this with you? I wrote this on, what was that, Monday, Tuesday this week, right? So we're doing this on Friday. We're recording this early, as we always do. But I'm just going to read you the first few lines and paragraphs. I'll get your initial response, mate. Then we'll go on to some of the bigger macro stuff. But here's what I wrote. As I write this, the ASX has just closed. The All Ordinaries is down another 2.3%. But some context. The All Ords is now at a level last seen in May last year. Yes, going nowhere in 8 months isn't great, but it's hardly a disaster, right? It's also still up 3% over the past 12 months, plus dividends, making the return probably somewhere close to 7 or 7.5%. Not ideal, but not terrible. The headlines will focus on the daily movements. The last week, maybe 2022 to date. Those numbers will be accurate and real, but they won't tell the story. Which is not to ignore the very real feelings of nervousness and fear that many people have right now. We humans are funny. We take the gains in our stride, but panic about falls of precisely the same size. If your $100 invested 12 months ago was worth $107.50 today, and you knew nothing else, you might wish the result was closer to the historical 9 or 11% average, but I doubt you'd give it a second thought. Isn't that how we should approach investing, though? I think so. And rather this week, just to kind of, again, that the whole, you know, again, I arbitrarily said, you know, 1 year trip around the sun, 7.5%. But it's just worth, I think, sometimes pointing out that you pick an arbitrary start date and you say, the market's at X since then. And that's, again, it's real, it's true. It's not, there's nothing fake about it. And, you know, if we had a perfect crystal ball, we would have sold on January 1 and waited until now and avoided the losses and all that kind of stuff. But perspective kind of helps, right?
Perspective is everything. Yeah. I mean, I think a useful analogy here is one perhaps you could draw between what the weather is and what the climate is.
Yeah.
You know, you can have a very cold summer day. You can have a very hot winter day, you know, but it's more about the broader picture, I suppose.
Yeah, I like that. That's a good point.
the tighter you zoom in, the more it's just noise. Yeah,
exactly.
And the broader you zoom out, it's more signal. There's no clear delineation. It's not like at exactly 482 days. Now it's real.
Exactly.
But that is the really challenging part. And we've said it before. Yeah. This is what makes this game so fascinating/frustrating is that you can do really dumb things and get rewarded. You can do really smart things and get punished.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think you're exactly right. Another thing that I saw on Twitter, which I just thought was excellent, from a guy called Ben Carson, a US investor that I follow. He actually published a table going back to 1928 for the US. And he next to each year, he said the year-end return, so how much the market was up or down in a calendar year. But next to that, he also had what is called the intra-year drawdown. So the biggest fall top to bottom throughout the year. And the title of the tweet was, "This is normal." And I retweeted it. So if you find me, you'll see it as the most recent tweet there. But it is so fascinating because obviously, as you'd expect, over all those years, we've had some up years, we've had some down years. For the statistically minded, it tends to be sort of 2 years up for every 1 year down on average.
Right. Yep.
The average tends to be around sort of 10%, but it's generally bottom left, top right, just in a zigzaggy line. The interesting thing was in the intra-year drawdown, there was some huge numbers, even in some of the most attractive years that we've had. Mm-hmm. 1987 was one that stuck out to me. So this was the big stock market crash of 1987. It was down 33.5% top to bottom in that year. But over the calendar year, it was actually up almost 6%.
It's crazy, hey?
Do you know what I mean? 2009, the GFC was an interesting one as well, although 2008 was probably when most of the damage was done. But still, in 2009, we saw 27% top to bottom. Yet overall, the year was up 25.9%.
That's crazy. Just think about those two numbers side by side.
Isn't it amazing? And the most recent year, just to bring it back to a more contemporary time frame, we've had 2020 was 18% up that year. Although in that year, obviously, which is when the pandemic first hit, it was down 34%. Mm-hmm. So it really is normal. I feel there's part of me that always feels a little bit Pollyanna-ish when you say these kinds of things,
because it
doesn't sound very smart to shrug your shoulders and go, this kind of stuff happens, and it always feels a bit different this time. And maybe it is. Maybe this is the other thing to draw from this observation is I want to be clear here. Neither of us are saying, that means it's fine and everything's going to go up from here. We're not. It could go down 50% more from here for all I know. I've got no idea. But the point is that although it's been a terrible start to the year, although there's lots of red on the screen, although some stocks have been really knocked around, it's actually just, it really is normal. This is genuinely what happens. You have you have to pan out.
You really, really do. I think it's a really good point. I think it's one of those things where I'll wrap for the second week in a row. Morgan Housel's book, The Psychology of Money. I like to make arbitrary rules and pretend stuff. I would literally tell anyone, don't invest another dollar till you've read this book. It literally is that good. But he talks about why pessimism sounds so smart. And it really, really does. And optimism sounds Pollyanna-ish. It sounds benign, neglectful, or even worse, actively neglectful. Why wouldn't you try and do this or try and do that? And it's kind of like that's the thing. You wouldn't try to do stuff if it was possible. It's not, the kind of the optimism or the benign neglect thing of like just let write it out is not because, we wouldn't want to do something better if it was possible to do. But sheer reality of this is trying to time the market is just dumb. It's probably going to cost you money. It's certainly going to cost you brokerage. You're probably going to pay more in tax. And you're probably still going to get it wrong on average. Yeah. We know 90% of day traders lose money. That numbers have been done sometimes up to 80-something percent of people who trade, I think it was CFDs, go broke. Literally, their accounts get wiped out. These things are not—
horrible products. If you're trading them, stop.
Don't. Seriously. Yeah. If you want to put your money on fire, give it to a charity instead. Seriously. If you want to be poorer, give it to charity rather than give it to some other bloke that's over a computer screen. The point was broadly that, if it was possible, we'd do it. That's the point. It's not possible. I wish it was. You can think it is. It's not. Don't do it. Stick with it. But let's go back a step because—
Can I just say, just quickly, please, mate, just on that. So At the current moment, the big, and well, this is what we're going to talk about, I suppose, but and we've been talking about for a while, in fact, which is kind of the point, which is the big boogeyman that's sort of out there at the moment is inflation. The US,
that's what's going to get back to.
The amount of US dollars in circulation is increased by almost 25% in the last few years. Yeah. It's phenomenal. The amount of, you know, money printing that has occurred has been rife. And so for the longest time, people have been saying this is going to lead to a lot of inflation. This is going to be really bad. The thing is, and maybe that's true, and that's what's got everyone worried at the moment. But just to follow on from your point, that point has been made, I think, as far back as they started doing a lot of this in the wake of the GFC for this quantitative easing, et cetera, et cetera. But to your point, had you thought, oh my gosh, this is terrible, this is going to lead to a lot of inflation, and I'm just going to move all to cash, and then I'm going to once sort of the dust settles, then I'll put it all back in. I.e., I'm going to try and time the market. Mm-hmm. You would have lost the opportunity cost; would have been staggering. And even if the market falls, you know, 40% from here, you're still going to be worse off than what you would have been. And yet, it wasn't a stupid or silly observation or prediction. There was a lot of good reason to think that perhaps this could have consequences. But that's exactly the point. Yeah, maybe that's true. As it turned out, it was a terrible, terrible thing to do to move your entire portfolio to cash a few years ago, because you've missed out on phenomenal gains in spite, in factoring in the current drawdown that we're experiencing.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Mate, let's spend a little bit more time in that macro space, then we'll get back to the kind of what it means for investors. But part of the last month, the worst start to the year for the S&P 500 in history, absolutely. And this is, you know, this is the stupidity of picking just arbitrary dates, right? The idea of moving, you know, if the year had finished on January 25, then last year's numbers would have been lower and we would have started with a better start, or you move it back a month and it changes. So it's all a bit silly, but it's worth talking about that fall, because the market's had a reasonably ordinary month. Mm. In fact, if you're a growth investor, it's fallen even further and harder. And there's a lot of stuff going on, mate. It's one of those things where I kind of, you know, sat down and as we started thinking about it, I wrote down inflation, interest rates, war, and a pandemic. So 2022 off to a good start, hey? And that's kind of what it feels like. And that's kind of why I, you know, it's, there's so much going on. Let's not get to investor mentality yet. Let's just stick with the facts for now. So let's go through them. Inflation in the US, 7%. The Fed is already talking about multiple rate hikes this calendar year. So that's the inflation interest rates part. There is some reasonable belief that Australian inflation will continue to rise. The Kiwis had their highest inflation rate in 31 years during the week. Mm. So it's you know, global inflation is really, really real. And it's something that central banks know if they don't do something about. And this is the interest rate challenge. I'll ask you about it in a sec, but just to quickly touch on it. You know, there are two ways that life can cost you more. Either you can pay more for your debts, or inflation can take away your purchasing power, or both. Mm. And neither is, you know, and sometimes you're after a least worse case choice, which is, do you want to pay more for your mortgage and business loans, or do you want to get less for your money? Because, and maybe it's both, or maybe it's neither. But if you've got to choose between those two, then you need to choose wisely. War is on the agenda, mate. The Russians are massing on the border with Ukraine. I'm no geopolitical military expert, certainly no Russia expert. I don't imagine you're much more qualified than I am in that area, but it's also weighing on markets right now what might happen, both from a purely geopolitical perspective, but remembering, of course, that Russia supplies much of Europe's winter gas. Now, in some senses, they're coming out of their winter, so maybe it's a good time to have a blue with them. But the reality is that petrol price is already $1.90 a litre in some places in Sydney, and around Australia. But it's kind of happening. And then the COVID stuff, this shadow lockdown that really is happening, whether you like it or not, not mandated, but people are choosing simply to say, I'm pulling my horns in. It's a heck of a quartet. Probably no surprise that the year is off to a rough old start. Let's I don't even know how to even start to handle it. We've talked about the pandemic a lot. We've talked about inflation interest rates a reasonable amount. The Ukraine war is different and kind of uncertain, unknowable. Let me start there. Potential for war in Ukraine, potential for higher tensions, maybe ongoing tensions between Russia and the West. Mm. It's going to hurt asset prices, particularly for commodity prices, particularly for energy. It has the chance to impact asset prices because people feel more fearful, particularly in the context of those other three things I talked about. If you're already saying, hey, I'm looking at the macro and saying, what are the reasons for hope? Well, maybe there's a recovery, maybe there's not. What are the reasons for fear? Well, the four horsemen of the apocalypse, you know, inflation, interest rates, war and pandemic. Mm-hmm. How do you think about the war in Ukraine or the potential for war in Ukraine in that context, mate, from an investing perspective?
Yeah, so let me be clear. This is from an investing perspective because, you know, there's mm-hmm. other more important perspectives that are out there in regards to that. But I'm very much what you would term a bottom-up investor. In other words, I'm very focused on the business sort of first and sort of the macro last. I mean, it is if that escalates, that has the potential to really do a lot of damage to sentiment. And sentiment is everything in the short term on the market. But again, at the risk of sounding Pollyanna-ish, what is the direct impact on pick a random company, zero, and its earnings capability? You know, what tensions, but are businesses around the world, particularly in the Asia Pacific, are they going to not renew their zero subscription as a result of this? Are they not going to be able, you know what I mean? It's sort of like you've got to sort of, I think, we talk about the market all of the time, which is this weighted index of all of the stocks that are on there. And, you know, obviously energy stocks, it's a little bit different, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But then within that, there's a bunch of companies, I would argue, with an entirely straight face, that probably won't have any impact whatsoever on the business, on sentiment, sure, on the share price, sure. In terms of how they earn a dollar and their long term future potential of earning more dollars, I really don't see how that has an impact. And so for me, when I see these things happen, that's always the question of the companies that I'm holding. How is this going to impact them and the actual business and its actual cash flows and its actual prospects? And for the most part, the answer is not much. It could mean, optimistically, or to look at it from an optimistic standpoint, that I have the opportunity to put a bit more money to work in some of these businesses because the market is freaking out about these kinds of things. And that is a nice set of circumstances when you have business conditions of potential quality, et cetera, not impacted, but price severely impacted. That's a really nice confluence of events, as opposed to the business suffering and the share price going down. So that's how I tend to think about that.
I like that, mate. I think it makes a whole lot of sense. I wonder if you can take me back to the business though, because the concerns might be around the squeezing of margins generally with higher costs, and we kind of talked to inflation a little bit, can be concerns of a global recession driven by some of this stuff that will not spare Australia. And to use the zero example, there may be fewer small businesses or simply businesses that won't pay or aren't prepared to pay that sort of money. And or maybe investors simply pay less for those lower profits or less for higher profits in a PE sense because of those general fears and concerns. Yep. To the extent that anything is only worth eventually what someone will pay for it. I mean, we can estimate value in the meantime, but if you want to sell your shares, you can only sell them at someone's giving you a price you think is worthwhile. How does that impact your concerns that the kind of the broader macro about what happens next?
No. And I think it's not because of the specific set of circumstances that we now face, but more at the time of making these investments. Mm. Did you make an investment in these particular businesses with the assumption that the world would never experience a recession?
Right.
I think that's really dangerous. I think that's where asset prices really start to get carried away. So did I know that, we haven't had one yet, but let's assume that there is a pretty nasty recession as a consequence of all of this kind of stuff. Did I know that we were going to have a recession in 2022 that was going to be driven by those unique events? No, of course not. Did I know that we were going to have a recession at some point? Yeah, of course I did. Like that's really, really easy to predict, you know, and that we will have, you know, we'll have recessions on a fairly regular basis. I mean, that is the economic cycle by definition. So I think, and this is what I think is interesting about this current sell down is that you're seeing the sentiment change and that's driving the prices down. But they're being driven down from levels that I would argue, particularly in tech, particularly in growth, that were just always crazy. Because we've used this term a number of times, but price for perfection really springs to mind. You've got these wonderful business. Like, I'll pick on Xero again, just for the sake of it. But what a wonderful business! I think it's one of the best businesses on the ASX. You know, it's even now, it's still trading on 20 times sales. Sales, not earnings, sales. You know, so, and this is particularly true in some of the smaller cap growth stocks, more speculative, and particularly in some of the, when you look at the US, I think it's something like 70% of the growth tech stocks are down more than 50%. So it's actually much worse than what the S&P 500 would have you believe, because some of the bigger, higher quality names there are masking a lot of the pain that is elsewhere. Yep. So you've got, I would actually argue that despite some of these nasty falls, things probably aren't great value for a lot of these names. They were always unreasonable. They never assumed that there would be any economic sort of speed bumps for whatever cause. And that growth would just continue at breakneck pace indefinitely into the future. That's a very difficult bet to make. So we've sort of said before, this was always my argument against Afterpay, a year or so ago. Is it a decent company in terms of how it's growing and its sales and the goals that it's kicking? Absolutely. But I mean, the price was just at an eye-watering level. And the danger is that when you're buying into stocks that are just stratospheric in their price and in their valuation, it only takes the slightest wobble for things to really, really come crashing down. So I don't know if that answers, it's a long-winded answer to the question, but I think that kind of gets at it. It is not to sort of say, this will never be impacted by a recession. Yes, it will, there was always going to be one. And whenever you're buying a company, if you're going to take that view that the future will be perfect without any difficulties whatsoever, whether it be business specific or sort of more from an economic a macro lens, then that's a very difficult bet to make. Because if you're right and that is true and that we never have any troubles again, you'll get an okay return. But if it's not, there's a very nasty asymmetry there. There's a lot more downside than there is upside. Now, call me crazy, but I prefer to see sort of positive asymmetry, whereas if I'm wrong, there's not too much I can lose, and if I'm right, there's a lot that I can make. It's Pabrai calls, heads I win, tails I don't lose too much. And I think that's the kind of thinking that you need when you make an investment. It's a very difficult standpoint to make, let it be said, when you sort of, and I speak from brutal experience on this front, where you say, well, that seems a little bit pricey, et cetera, et cetera. And then it goes up and then it goes up and then it goes up. And this plays out over a period of years. I mean, you've got a lot of egg on your face there, but it's as painful as that is, it's still not a game I'm willing to play, because again, it seems as though the odds are stacked against me. There will come a point in the future when that situation is reversed, where it's kind of like, yeah, could things get worse? Yes, they could, but the price is really not that demanding. It's not really, there's not a lot of expectation price. So even if it does, there's not too much more downside. But if the future is a little bit brighter than we're all assuming at that point in time, then there is a lot of upside to be had. That's the dynamic that I'm looking for.
Nice, mate. We'll come back to Afterpay in a minute because it's worth chatting about.
Motley Fool Money. For more, subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/listener.
Let's just rewind a little bit. We've talked about this before, and I'm mindful of covering the same stuff too regularly because our listeners either get it or have already heard it and don't want to hear it again or don't need to hear it in the first place. And yet, I'm going to go back there because when we talk about inflation interest rates, this hits the Xero type stories again from a different perspective. And this is why it's really, really, really important, because all the things you just said are absolutely true in the absence of the macro. Paying 20 times sales for Xero is a heck of a price. And yes, well, what's that, absent Xero? You talk about the absent macro. You said it, the recession comes and people aren't allowing for it. And so, you look at that and go, man, that was expensive even if there was no recession. If there is one, it's even more expensive. That's crazy. And I think that's absolutely true. But then there's the stuff that's actually going to be happening to us, which isn't just purely recession or recession at all, which is this change to inflation and interest rates.
Mm.
And we're going to get to housing in a minute too. And so we're going to trample all over some of these topics and try and come back to them. But there's a reason to come back to housing, by the way, other than to let you rant. I was asked on Twitter, and I don't want you answering housing. I'm going to ask you to hold your tongue just so we can keep on track. But by way of analogy, to set the scene, I wasn't asked on Twitter. There was a message on Twitter talking about the fact that, hey, interest rates will go up, but housing will be okay because borrowers are ahead on their mortgages. And my response was true, absolutely true. But housing pricing is on the margins. It's only the transactions that count, not the houses that aren't sold. So if I'm 10 years ahead or right on the line of my mortgage, but I don't sell, my personal circumstances don't impact the price of housing, only those who buy and sell. And interest rates by themselves should make it harder to borrow money. The banks will have a lower borrowing limit and you'll have to pay more back for the same value house because your interest rate's higher on the same amount you borrow. So I'm going to leave housing there, mate. And I'm sorry to do that to you. We will come back.
I'll bite my tongue.
But when you think, here's the analogy. So that hopefully is reasonably straightforward to people, right? You can have a different view. You can take a different perspective. But broadly speaking, higher rates should mean lower prices mathematically. Now, there's not just maths involved. There's emotion, other things. But let's just, so I use the housing example because it's kind of easy for people to conceptualize. Mm. When they talk about shares and you say, okay, well, zero is expensive. Zero is expensive in a 0.1% interest rate world.
Mm.
Where profits are probably a decent way into the future, or at least profits that justify the price are well into the future.
Mm.
But in a world where inflation is higher, a dollar in the future is worth even less than it would have been in a low inflation world. So if you give me a dollar and say, look, how much you want back in a year's time, you're going to say, well, I want more than a buck. Thank you very much. I want some return. Not only that, then I say to you, actually, well, the purchasing power of that dollar is going to be 96 cents by then. You're like, well, I want even more back than to cover that.
Yeah.
Because not only am I missing the return, I'm actually, time is eroding that value. And so if you think about the profits of companies, this is the point I really want to get to. Think about the profits of companies the share price of companies whose profits are years away, or not even just total profits, but profits that justify the price are years away. Think about the combined impact of inflation and interest rates on that dollar of profit. If you get a dollar's profit in 2028 or 2032 or 2069, probably too far away to think about, the value of that was already low. It gets lower and kind of almost exponentially lower, not quite, but compound-wise gets lower, the longer out you wait. And so it has reasonably said to a whole lot of people, hey, should you really pay that much money for that loss-making business or that business is only making a few dollars of profit? Because by the time you get them, it's worth it less than you thought it was. Again, logically, those things should be worth less.
Yeah.
The dollars of profit you're going to get in a few years' time are worth less because interest rates and inflation are higher. When they're both higher, it's even worse.
Mm.
And by the way, that uncertainty is still there. And if they're carrying debt or going to want to get money from the market to fund their expansion, that's going to be more expensive as well. So I'm not a bear at all on growth companies. I actually quite like growth companies. But it's absolutely logical. If you look at that and say, why have my tech shares fallen 25%? Now, I'm not saying 25 is right necessarily, but it's absolutely right to my mind. And this is a bit more a statement than a question, Matt, but I'll get you to respond. It's absolutely right to my mind that you should be paying a decent amount less for a company if you're banking future profits after accounting for inflation and interest rates. Am I completely nuts?
No. That's 100% true. Now, the rationale, of course, is that that's still okay if those profits are big enough. Mm. And here's the danger, right? So everyone points, and we've done this before too, everyone points to Amazon, right? Which famously bled cash forever. You know, before they turned the profit tap on. Mm-hmm. And the reason they were bleeding cash was not because of the poor unit economics or anything like that. It's just because anytime they made some money, they took that and then some more and reinvested it back into the business. Mm-hmm. And it turned out to be a very smart thing to do because now the cash flows today justify the prices that people were paying. The trouble with it is that Amazon is the exception, not the rule.
Exactly.
You know me, I like my small cap stocks. And the number of times you sort of see these little $50 million Aussie tech companies that have barely made any sales sort of trying to, well, not maybe I shouldn't pick on the companies, certainly some of the people that follow them rationalize and justify the price by sort of saying, ah, yes, but that's what Amazon did. You know, it's okay for them to do it. And they're right. They are right. Yeah. But there's a very, it's like you say, the biggest little word in the English language, if indeed those cash flows come and they are significant enough.
Yeah.
And to your point is they have to be really significant and not too far away.
Because
if they're not, you know, as you say, a small increase in interest rates and therefore an increase in what we call the discount rate, how much we discount those future interest rates back, cash flows back, makes a massive difference, makes a huge difference. And it comes back to my point of being careful of paying for perfection, because anything short is going to lead to a lot of pain.
Which doesn't mean, you know, I own Amazon shares for full disclosure. It doesn't mean you shouldn't buy growth companies. It doesn't mean you shouldn't. And if they compound nicely over a long enough period of time, they will leave all of these concerns in the dust, right? If you were worried about buying Amazon because of inflation when the shares were $100, they were now $3,000, what they are now. Maybe they would have been $2,500 or $2,000. You would have still made $1 squillion. So it's not to say don't buy growth companies or don't value compound growth, but there is a real question to be asked by the individual investor of how sure am I? How likely is it? As you say, the if word. How much am I paying for it? What's my potential return? Let me go on a tangential rant, mate, while we're here. I really have an issue with, I don't know who. The idea that tech stocks are great or growth stocks are great or the returns from growth stocks have been great, so they will be in the future. And let me unpack that a little bit, because I've just said I like growth companies, and I really do. But you've mentioned the difference between companies and stocks in passing as you were chatting before, and it's a really good point. I've said this before, and I'll say it again. I'll probably say it again and again. People love tech stocks because of this huge growth rate. But the only way that any company, including those tech stocks, can give you market-beating growth is if the market underestimates the future and you get it right.
Yeah.
And when I say the market underestimates the future, Amazon was never, in theory, at least in hindsight, and there's massive hindsight, so we'll come back to that. I'm not blind to that. Amazon was never worth $5 or $100 or $1,000 a share when it was trading for those prices. If you had perfect foresight, the Amazon share price should have been, I'm going to say, $1,000 in 1999.
Yeah, so sort of the current price discounted back by about 10% each year to that point.
Exactly. And whatever that number is, it might be $800, it might be whatever. It was never $3 and it was never $9, never $100, right? The growth of that Amazon over time has been, I suppose, I don't know, 20% a year or something since then, when the market's up 10% a year. So you were getting a fantastic bargain because the market said, I don't think that's going to happen, I don't believe it. Now, others went broke. So you're not wrong to say, will a startup e-commerce company make a fortune? Should I really pay that much for it? No, absolutely not. But what I do think, mate, is that you talk about zeros. I looked at the PE. Zero's selling for 2,800 times earnings right now. Now, I'm not a zero bear at all. Don't get me wrong. What I would say is the market is already pricing in a bright future for zero. At that EPE. Amazon was never at 2,800 times earnings in 1997, right?
Yeah.
And that's, so if you think about that and think about, and by the way, Xero is a much more mature company than Amazon was in 97. Like this is, Xero is probably Amazon of 2012, pick a number. But when you're paying 2,800 times earnings for this business, or you're paying, I was on the call on Ausbiz the other day, there was at least two or three companies we talked about that were 45 times earnings. Now, what that says is the market's already pricing in the growth that you're hoping for. And so when you buy a company, even if a company is the next Amazon, if it's legitimately the next Amazon, but if you're being offered shares for the equivalent of $1,000 rather than $3 at that same point in Amazon's life, then the future returns you shouldn't expect will be spectacularly great because it's already priced into the shares. The only way a company can outperform, literally the only way a company can outperform, is if the current market's view is underestimating the future potential for that business. That's almost by definition.
Yes.
Because if every business was priced perfectly, it wouldn't matter whether you're a garbage collector or a high-flying.com stock or a social network or, God forbid, crypto. If the market values it correctly based on what the assets can be worth in 10 years' time, then every one of those assets will give you exactly the same return, which is not to say tech can't do well because people do underestimate it. And so there's not, I'm not saying you can't beat the market at all. I think you can. You think we can. That's what you and I do for a day job. But it's just a reminder that the only reason that tech as a group or even growth as a group gives any sort of outperformance is because the market is underestimating the current, you know, currently is underestimating the future returns. And it may always do that and there may always be opportunity. But I just want people to remember, it's not like, hey, find the latest tech stock and to your point, it's the next Amazon or the next Microsoft or the next Cisco or the next Facebook or the next whatever. Company-wise, that might still be true. But it's actually possible Amazon lost money. If Amazon had been priced at $4,000 a share on listing because people paid 2,800 times earnings, Amazon would have been the greatest growth story ever that investors lost money on.
Yeah.
And that's entirely possible as well. End rant.
Yes. Yeah. No, 100% agree. So I'll start by saying I really hate the labels of growth and value. Oh,
me too.
And all of, you know, I think growth investing tends to suggest that it doesn't matter what price you pay if it's growing fast enough.
Oh,
and I mean, it's silly.
Literally, like fundamentally, mathematically stupid.
Yeah.
Munger
says that, you know, growth and value joined at the hip. And he's right, because I far prefer, there's a term you may have come across called GARP, mm-hmm. G-A-R-P, growth at reasonable price. So there's nothing, look, whatever your style is, you can buy a business whose earnings are declining by 10% each year and still do really well.
Yeah, that's right.
If you pay a low enough price.
Yes, exactly.
And you can buy a company, to your point, whose earnings are doubling every year and do really, really badly. If you pay, no company is worth an infinite price, to quote Charlie Munger again. So you're 100% right. You have to have all of that factored in. I think there's a bit of a narrative hangover too with tech, because I mean, think about the recent, when I say recent, let's go back a decade or so. What we've had in tech are these huge structural disruptions of existing industries. So we've talked about real estate .com before, right? So everything was on all these classified businesses that were all in the papers, and that just completely went away. And that was completely eaten by these companies, car sales, et cetera. Yep. And they just had insane high growth. Now, these very, very high sales multiples were actually much more justifiable back then. The returns were much more attractive. As we've said before, we talk about Amazon, real estate was actually a better performer. Mm-hmm. Realestate.com, I should say, was a better performer.
Yeah.
Why? Does it earn as much as Amazon or anything like that? Or did it grow as much? No, I don't think it did. But the market didn't get it. In 2022... Yeah. I think that epiphany has been had by people. And we're now in a world where tech is everywhere. So it's kind of like, just because you're a tech company doesn't mean you've got this automatic guarantee of incredibly insane eye-watering growth. Yeah. Those big structural transitions, for the most, not in all cases. There's still exceptions, of course. That's that's what I'm on the hunt for. but a lot of them have now played out. Now you're competing against other tech companies. Now you're competing against others who get the business model. Now you're being priced in a market for people who understand the potential for all of this. So it's very, very different. So I think, you know, someone in 2006 could have made a lot of these arguments and been extremely right and been extremely well rewarded. It's just a much more difficult argument when almost everything is tech to some degree. I mean, even your boring old retailers are very heavily in tech these days, with, you know, these omni-channel retailers with, you know, online sales and all the rest. It's kind of sort of permeated everything. Software is eating the world I'm not going to remember the person who said it, but to quote someone.
Mark Andreessen it was, mate. Mark Andreessen.
Andreessen, that's
not JP Morgan. Mark Andreessen this time.
Exactly. So, yes. It comes back to an oft-quoted thing that I say, which is, you know, valuation matters. And yes, things can grow faster than other things, but at the end of the day, you need to pay a price that is sensible, and that price will only be sensible on the basis that your expectations for those future cash flows are reasonable. Yeah. And what you want is a situation where the market's completely underestimating that. That's where the big money's made.
Yeah, I think that's important. I think what investors run the risk of is making the mistake of conflating the business, the wonderful business model and economics for the share price. We did a quick plug. We're going to release a video on next Tuesday on our YouTube channel. So quick plug for the YouTube channel. Just go to YouTube, search for The Motley Fool Australia. Trevor Machesi, who's a spectacular analyst that I work with, is reviewing a book called Capitalism Without Capital. And that very idea of the business model benefits of having a capital light business. I won't steal all of his thunder. Go and watch the video. But it is obviously true that Xero's business is a superior business model to a steel mill or a car manufacturer, because you don't need to add more capital to sell more units, right? Mm. More cars, more bars of steel, okay, more factories, more people, more inputs, more costs, another version of zero software, literally zero, cost nothing. Zero with a Z, cost nothing. It is obviously a superior business model if you can make it once, sell it a million times for almost free.
Yep.
But, and that's great, but, and you should absolutely pay more for a business that has that because its future profitability is going to be higher, its future growth rates and the ability to aggregate that profit is going to be higher. But at some point, you can underpay, as you just said, mate, the worst business, the kind of 10% a year, you know, can be a better deal. At a price, the shares of poor old struggling General Motors are better value than the price of high-flying zero. Now, I don't know what that price is. I don't know that either company is the price where I'd say I'd prefer one over the other just yet. But that very reality of just because the business model is great is nowhere near enough to say, and therefore you should pay whatever price the market is asking,
yep.
as you've just so rightly pointed out. I think it's a really, as investors, we all struggle sometimes to separate the price from, or the stock from the company.
Yep.
And you've got to do that. You've got to be able to say, man, what a great company, but gee, I can't pay the price. Or man, what a crappy company, gee, it's a really cheap price, I'll buy some. Or hopefully, what a great price, gee, what a great company, and I get the benefit of both. And man, if I can buy Amazon again for $3 a share, then I'm going to do it every day of the week. Because if I can find the next Amazon at $3, I'm there.
Yep.
If I find the next Amazon that's already selling for $5,000 per share, and again, in equivalent senses, I'm going to say, nah, you know what? I love the business, but I'm not going to pay that price. And the market's caught on.
Yep.
The market has absolutely caught on. So just be careful out there. If you're buying companies because they're great, because they have great economics, it's just nowhere near enough. And you can't just say, like we say all the time, mate, you know, focus on the business, not the share price. You know, the share price is in the business. Look at the business. See if you like it. Mm. Those things are absolutely true. And I'm really just saying what you just said before, which is valuation matters. Mm. You can't allow analysis of the business model alone to be enough.
Yep. And look, there's exceptions to that as well. So there's a couple they're not well-known businesses, but there's a company out there called ARB. So anyone who drives a four-wheel drive will know what I'm talking about.
Mate, you
know,
I have spent a little bit too much money at ARB just quietly. I've got a Hilux and a Prado. So have you heard the phrase all gear, no idea?
I haven't.
That is absolutely. So my young bloke introduced me to me when I did Kokoda. I spent again a lot of money on gear. I said, right, you're good. He said, we've got a name for people like you. So what's that? He said, all gear, no idea. Which I think is great. I've never done it before. Right? He's like, you got all the great gear. You're on your own now. And it's kind of the same with a car. I've got this four-wheel drive gear on my cars. And, you know, I got a little bit more than no idea, but not much. Anyway, mate, massive tangent. Go on. ARB, lots of gear.
My point was that it makes four-wheel drive accessories. You know, it's actually a fairly capital-intensive business. You know, their net profits have tripled since 2013.
Yeah.
Maybe not that much. It's certainly gone up a hell of a lot. Supply Networks is the one I'm thinking of. These are on the provide aftermarket parts and service to trucking fleets, bus fleets, etc. Get boring as, right? This is not a sexy tech business. They have tripled their earnings since 2013. So again, just because something isn't tech doesn't mean that you can't do ridiculously well on them. Both of investors, long-term investors in both of those companies have done exceedingly well. So, yes.
That's so true. That's so, I love that point, mate. It's, it's one I ask people all the time, you know, we talk about, customer retention rates, right? And we talk about recurring revenue. And I say to people, you know, which business in Australia have got the highest level of customer retention and the highest recurring revenue? And people throw out zero and other things. And you know the answer? It's the supermarkets and the banks.
Yeah.
The customer retention at a bank is spectacularly good.
Yeah.
The loyalty of a Woolworths or a Coles shop is spectacularly good. The recurring revenue. Who doesn't shop at Woolies or Coles once a week at least, if not two or three times? I mean, and this is the thing. And of course people are saying, well, yeah, but it's not the same. It's not software. And of course they're different. But it's that idea of like, if you get caught up in customer acquisition cost and whatever, you should be buying Woolies. If that's what actually mattered. And I'm not saying customer acquisition cost doesn't matter. I'm not saying you can't look at a growing company and do something different. But you think about that and think, If you don't define your terms properly, you fall to the victim of these buzzwords of, oh, how good is, you know, high customer retention? Well, so you're buying Woolies? No. Well, so is that really the point then? Is that really the point, you know?
Yeah.
I just think it's, you got to be so careful. Woolies are not growing. The banks aren't growing, at least not much. They won't, and that's fine. And I'm not saying you should put them in the same bucket as Zero or Supply Network or anything else. It's just worth being careful with the business model buzzwords. And when the market's going up, by the way, and let's go back to the market, everyone feels smart because you say, I'm going to buy a business with low customer acquisition cost, high recurring revenue, great, you know,
high net
dollar retention rate. Exactly, right? And, and the shares go up and you go, see, I'm a genius.
Yeah.
And when the share price goes down, people say, bloody market. I'm a genius when the shares are going up. It's the market when it's going down. And they weren't even wrong and the share prices might recover. And you've made the point, mate, before, and it's a really, really, really good one. The Afterpay story, we'll come back to that one. It was $156 when the Square takeover was announced. They delisted and became Square shares, or Block as it's now called, at $66 a share. Back where they were in 2020, not that long ago, and if you bought shares before then, you still made a lot of money. But if you bought shares any point between, I think it was July 2020 and today, you lost money. There was no, the price was lower, I think, once during that two-year period, right, year and a half period. And it was a great takeover price and all that good stuff. And maybe Block goes on to do well. Maybe the share price recovers. And I guess my point is, I'm not saying it's a terrible company or you've made a bad idea because the shares have fallen since. Nor was I saying it's a great business because the shares went from 66 to 156 in the meantime. That's all noise, right? But if you'd have closed the doors a year and a half ago, come back today, your shares about the same price. Okay, cool. Everyone else has been all over the place, and you're like, oh, that seemed okay, fine. I'm disappointed. I wanted more, but that's fine. Just because the shares move in either direction, particularly when the market's rising and falling and everything's going along for the ride, just don't make the mistake of thinking you're a genius or an idiot because the price in the short term do that. So many examples of businesses, even Amazon, mate, it's fallen more than 50%. I think it's more than a dozen times from high to low in its life, right? And it's gone from 3 to 3,000 in the meantime. So just because they fall doesn't mean you're an idiot. Just because they rise, just be careful not to think you're a genius because these things have a way of working out in the long run.
I think when we have these conversations too, hopefully it sort of resonates and makes sense, but it does. I know, and people have said to me, it's just like, yeah, but how? It's so hard. How do we do all of this stuff?
Exactly.
And yeah, it can be, but really, I also think too, you can simplify it. It's bloody share price movements that just really distract us. And I think you could take any average person and just forget about the share market and say, I've got a cafe. Do you want to buy it? I mean, and what do you look at? You don't want to ask, well, what are the last five people you offered it to want to pay?
Want to pay? That's a great way to do it.
Do you know what I mean? Like, they'll say, okay, well, what was your sales last year? How much profit did you make on that? What was it the year before? Like, what do you think I can reasonably do in the future? You'd make a very sensible decision. You certainly wouldn't take that cafe and pay 100 times what last year's profit was, unless for some reason you thought you could, you know, start selling 1,000 more coffees a day.
Let me go even further, mate. Because if the three cafes in the area were also selling for 100 times sales or earnings,
yes,
you don't look at the cafes and go on, wow, they're really going really well. I guess I should buy a cafe too at 100 times earnings. That sounds like a great idea to me because look at the price action. Cafes have gone up in, you know, it's like, remember pubs? Pubs were stupidly expensive. I don't know what they are now, but there was this time when everyone was paying $1 squillion for pubs and everyone did because everyone did. And then everyone stopped.
Yeah.
And like in real businesses, these, you know, I mean, businesses on the stock market are real businesses too, but I'm talking about whole businesses were selling for stupid prices. And all of a sudden everyone went, oh, that's a dumb idea. And the prices of pubs cratered. And everyone was just following the leader. It didn't make them worth more because other people were paying them. It was just they were exhibiting stupidity and you either choose to join the stupidity or say, no, I see what's going on there. The old emperor's new clothes thing, you know. Yeah. Someone's going to say, nah, it's not okay.
And it's exactly the way to think about it, right? So if I had a cafe and I'd held it for 10 years, you know, and it's been a reasonably successful one. You know, maybe after everything, all costs, wages, everything, you know, maybe I make $100,000 a year. And over the last 10 years, it's managed to sort of increase a little bit. I've gotten a bit more productive. I've gotten some good loyalty, but you know, I'm probably growing, generally speaking, a business like that, maybe 3-5% a year kind of thing. You know, you'd probably be really happy to buy that off me for 4 or 5 times earnings because you know, I mean, just think about it from this way. Forget about your capacity to sell this to someone else. You just own this thing now and you own it till the end of days. It's like, well, I'll run it for another 4 or 5 years and I'll make all of my money back on the purchase price. And then every year after that, it's just pure gravy, right? Like that's a really great investment. Assuming that I don't destroy the business by, you know, starting to sell really bad coffee and be rude to all the customers, et cetera.
Exactly.
At the same time, you know, if you were to, you know, my $100,000 annual profit, if you were to pay $3 million for that, wow, you know, it's going to be 30 years, excluding inflation, excluding opportunity cost, excluding all those kinds of things, before I even get back my purchase price, and then I can actually make a return on that. Mm-hmm. So it's really a simple way of looking at it, but that is exactly the way that you look at it with shares. For those that are out there going, oh, it all sounds very complicated, look at it like that. I've often said, pretend you're a billionaire and you're a multi-billionaire in the case of some of these companies, and you're thinking of buying the whole damn thing. And then once you own it, that it's yours. It's not something that will be traded. You will just continue to hold this forever. You know, what would you pay? What would you pay if the market just closed all of a sudden and you were just left as an owner of this business and your returns only come from the distributions, the dividends that you can pay yourself and other owners of the business, then that's exactly the way to think of it. It's just such a great mindset. And it just dissociates you from what everyone else, what the mob is thinking. And if all the lemmings are running towards a cliff and happy to do whatever, you don't have to participate in that. But you will find a point in time, many points in time, and many exceptions to the rule when everyone else is sort of doing crazy things, where you will get that 100 grand a year net profit cafe being available for 200 grand. It's like, I'm whole after 2 years and the rest is just pure profit. That's a great opportunity. It doesn't mean that it can't go lower from there, but that is the way to think about it without having to get too advanced with discounted cash flows and advanced valuation metrics and models and discount rates, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Think about it with common sense. And fortunately on the market, common sense is not too common. And the combination of a longer time frame is a very, very powerful combination.
Yeah, I agree. And that is the opportunity, right? I think that's where you can start to make sense. And this is what, I guess the last thing I'll say quickly before we move on, because we've banged this drum a little bit, but the other thing I think it's worth mentioning is I'm not saying anyway, avoid growth stocks or even avoid stocks that are 100 times earnings. If you have a business that is, you know, strongly profitable, growing nicely, but is going to, you know, got lots of growth ahead of it, again, buying Amazon for $300 or $100 or $1,000 was always a good idea.
Dude, right? I've got stocks always, that are on infinity times earnings.
Right, exactly. So we're not saying don't do it at all. We're not saying, you know, the only way you can invest is to buy a stodgy, boring, you know, no growth stocks at 12 times earnings. We're not saying that at all. All we're saying is just do the maths and understand what that path looks like. And yeah, absolutely be critical of your assumptions in terms of, will there be a recession? What will happen? If rates go up, what will happen? If investors want to pay less of my shares as a multiple of earnings in 10 years because of higher rates, what happens? So do that stuff. And if you still think it's a great idea to buy it, then do it. And Andrew has some of those. I have some of those. That's, you know, completely an appropriate thing to do. Just be really, really, really sensible and don't get caught up with either the crowd of tech always wins or growth always wins. Certainly don't get caught up with shares are growing, therefore I'm a genius, or shares are falling, therefore I'm an idiot. Just make sure you do the work on the business, understand what its future might look like, and then work out how much you want to pay for those shares.
Yep, exactly it.
Mate, let's move on to retail for a minute, because it's kind of almost a version of what we just talked about. We haven't got that much time left, but it's been an interesting little while. We've seen Adairs, I own shares in Kogan, we've seen them come out. Premier Investments has been out, JB Hi-Fi has been out, Accent Group I think has come out. And the shares of most of these companies have been reasonably whacked by the market for disappointing sales and profit results relative to last year. And you and I talked about it before we taped, and we both agree, I think you said, but it's certainly my thought, what was the market expecting? Mm. We've known for weeks that late December was a crappy, crappy, crappy couple of weeks in their busiest, normally busiest time of the year. If you want to have two bad weeks of sales, you don't want those to be your Christmas weeks.
No.
And that exactly happened because of the Omicron wave that hit the country. I won't go into the politics of it. Let's just say that. And we knew that. We absolutely knew that. We also knew that last year was a great year because everyone, particularly for those retailers with big online businesses, and all those people who were spending money in places like JB and Adairs to fill up their homes with stuff they liked because they were cocooning or nesting, whatever you call it these days, those things weren't surprising. I am flabbergasted that we got to a point where people said, Oh, it started out. That's a massive surprise. I'm going to sell my shares. And I'm going to, you know, the shares are going to fall. I think Adairs was down 20%, you said.
Yeah.
And you can't, I'm always amazed by the market. I don't know what else they were expecting. Obviously not something like this. I don't know why. I don't know what they were smoking or where they were sleeping and not paying attention, but surely it was possible, right?
I think so. Or I likely. Mean, I've been doing it long enough to know that it, you know, that it was going to be a bad result and the market was, you know, certainly not going to go up that day.
Yeah.
But the magnitude of the fall really did stump me. I mean, just speaking of Adairs, I mean, their sales in the first half were 34% above where they were in FY20.
Right, exactly.
You know, their online sales doubled over that period. But compared to FY21, actually the first half sales were actually, well, let's call it flat, was down half of 1%.
Yep.
You know, and they had flagged in their first quarter exactly how difficult it had been with the Delta lockdowns, et cetera, in the first quarter, you know, even before Omicron had come along. And it just, and everyone just got really scared and ran away. I don't know why it's surprising that I'm surprised, I suppose, is that's what should be surprising. But it is a good reminder that the market can do really crazy things. Maybe the market was actually acting very rational in that sell down, and the price was just never justified in the first place. So I'll put that out there. I don't think that is the case, frankly. I own shares too in Adairs, but yeah, it's, you know, you shrug your shoulders, you go on. I did have another mate of mine who he's got some as well. It's like, oh, are you going to sell? And it's like, well, what? Why? I don't understand what's changed. But the price is down. It's like, yeah, and it sucks. I'm not happy about that. By the way, my entire portfolio is down about 20% in the last 3 months.
Yeah, so, mate, mine's not much off that. It's brutal.
Just to put you, you know, just so you know, for anyone out there who's saying, oh, you guys don't get it. I get it, right? I really get it. It sucks.
Totally, totally.
But at the same time, you know, over a much longer period and on a compound basis, very nice, thank you very much. And of the companies I'm holding, I really don't think, you know, it was never purchased on the expectation of what the second half was going to be like in FY22.
Yeah.
And nothing has really changed other than that. So, you know, I don't know. I shrug my shoulders and carry on.
It's kind of a bit like that, hey. It's interesting. Mate, let's finish off. I promise you get to rant about property. And we haven't got much time left. It wasn't deliberate, but let's try and keep the rant as short as we can. Or not. Maybe you've got some new information to share with me. Property prices. I tweeted during the week. I love this. I just have retweeted someone's tweet. I can't remember who it was. My apologies. It was just a stat that housing was up 22% during 2021. I just retweeted because I retweet some... retweet some, you know, economic data from time to time, the ABS data or, you know, home loans or, you know, just whatever's going on, just because my followers are sharing with my followers. That's kind of what you do, right? And you sent me a message saying, are you trolling me with that house price stuff? which I quite loved. I
took it personally.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know if you're completely serious, but I like to think you were, that you thought I might be doing just to have a go at you. It's a remarkable stat, mate. These are all, of course, pre-interest rates. And again, 95% of the year was pre-Omicron wave. We don't think anyone really has changed their buying behavior on the back of that. Mm. I was a little bit surprised because the new buffer rates from APRA came into effect in October, or I think. But it was still a remarkable year. I'm going to assume you think that's an unreasonable gain.
Well, again, to be fair, I might surprise you here. I think, again, you've got to... We've just started the podcast talking about, well, that's just over the last year. Is there much significance? Mm-hmm. You've got to look at the broader trend. So I will mm-hmm. put that out there as well.
Yeah, that's okay.
You know, if you go back to five, so you go back 5 years ago since 2017, we actually in 2017, mm-hmm. 2018 mm-hmm. and beginning of 2019, prices actually came down a bit, believe it or not, on average. So over that mm-hmm. period, it's not 22% compound. So you do have to look at it in context.
Oh, come on.
But it's interesting. I think a lot of people make that point that you did before is that should interest rates go up? Well, one, buffers have been in place. Banks have hopefully been prudent in measuring their clients' ability to repay. I don't think there's going to be mass defaults or anything like that. But I do have some concerns for people who have been buying at very elevated prices that even if they can continue to service the loan and that, particularly those that have been negatively geared, and that is they've structurally set themselves up to lose money every year to save a bit on tax and justify that years down the track by a massive capital gain. I think that is increasingly being called into question. You know, when something goes, put it this way, we always try to link value back to sort of earnings and earnings capacity.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, on property, that's rent, right? As an investment property. And so rents didn't go up 22% last year. You know, so on a PE basis for a house, it's just kind of got really getting up there. And what you need to do, this is exactly the conversation we had before, what you need to do to justify that is to expect very sustained and significant increases in the ability of that investment to generate income, i.e. rent, or you need a very firm belief that the market will continue to pay very, very high multiples of that rent.
Yeah, right.
And maybe that's true.
Yep.
Maybe it's true. But I would also go back to my earlier comments that there's asymmetry in that bet. That's kind of like they're two pretty optimistic outlooks. And maybe, I'm not going to do a Steve Keen here and sort of call a crash or anything like that. But if that is not true, there is even if you manage to service the damn thing, that big fat capital gain in 3, 4, 5 years might not be there. And then what you've got is something that's actually losing you money each year. And then eventually when you sell it, you lose a bit more money again, even though you haven't had to be a forced liquidator or anything like that. That's my concern. Two quick comments on that. One, there is a very, very big difference between buying somewhere to live in and buying something as an asset. So I really want to make that point. I think it's very different if you're buying a house to live in for the next 30 years and you're very comfortable in your ability to service it. The utility you get out of that is insane. That's totally different. If you're the teacher who's got 6 different investment properties leveraged up to 90%, you know, that's something else entirely. So I think that's a point. And the final point I'd make, I think what's really interesting about this whole situation is that this is a word that got really popular during the GFC, but I think there's a really huge moral hazard in all of this because no matter what happens, the government is going to do whatever it can.
Yeah, that's right.
Whatever it can to mitigate that. So it's kind of like that's probably the smartest argument for going all in because they're going to do whatever they can to avoid that because any whoever's in government when or if property has a be careful here my language if property has a big fall is absolutely going to get turfed out in the next election. And it's also something that not just for their own political self-interest, just for the broader economic health of the economy. If property was to fall significantly, we're all screwed, whether you own a property or not. Because even if you're managing to stay solvent and service these huge loans, you've got far less money that with higher interest rates that you could spend on a holiday or on a new toy or on other, you know, handbag, whatever it is that you're buying. so it's gonna have huge ramifications for the wider economy and almost certainly would instill a very deep recession. So that's why it's a moral hazard. Government, and this is why Steve Keen was wrong. Poor old Steve, we mention him a lot. But, you know, I think he was right. He was absolutely right except for he didn't factor in the policy response.
Correct.
And that's why I'm very mindful too, because while I think in a pure objective, rational, you know, hyper financial sort of lens, this all looks pretty crazy. I'm very mindful of the fact that no government is going to let that happen if they can avoid it. And it's going to be interesting. I think the danger in here is as with shares is that what a lot of people will do is they'll see that, wow, 22%, all it's done is gone up. I have to get in now. There's massive FOMO that's there. One, because I want some of those gains.
Yeah, exactly.
I've waited I've waited for too long. But also for the poor old first home buyers, just like, man, I've waited and waited and waited. I've got to do it because, you know, if I don't do it now, it'll be another 22% higher next year. And you know, I really feel for them. I actually feel as though it's the biggest driver in wealth inequality in Australia. We've seen what's happened in the US for slightly different reasons. But I feel as though there's two classes in Australia, those that own property and those that don't. Those that have over any meaningful period are laughing. You know, those that haven't are an extraordinarily difficult position and which with very little hope, frankly, of getting out of that, unless there is a massive price correction there that brings it to a more affordable kind of level. And that gap is just growing. And I think that actually has big impacts for society and longer term the economy as well.
Yeah, I like it. Really good points, Matt. I won't continue. I share most of those thoughts. I have some different ones, but I share most of them. So that'll probably do us. Matt, will you join me on Sunday for a mailbag?
You know it.
Beautiful. Fools, please do follow us on the socials. If you want to ask a question, let us know. You can do all of that good stuff. You can hit us up on any of the socials. Let's start with Twitter because that's where Ram is. Go to Sage_Sibian or at StrawmanInvest on Twitter. On both Twitter and Insta, you can grab me at TMFScottP or The Motley Fool at The Motley Fool AU. You can hit us up on Facebook at facebook.com/ScottPhillipsMoney or facebook.com/TheMotleyFoolAustralia. I haven't done this for a while. Could you please, if you do enjoy the podcast, leave us a review, particularly on Apple Podcasts. Others don't tend to have the same review functionality, but people find podcasts based on reviews, based on listenership. If you like them, want to share them with your friends, please do that as well. I've said this before, but not for a while. We do this for you for effectively free. I get paid, and hopefully it helps Andrew's business as well. So we get paid to do this, and we get some ad money as well, of course. But frankly, if none of those was true, Andrew and I would still be here because it gives us a chance to talk stocks and investing. We love doing it. But please help us help other people. So if you do like what we're doing, if you think that you've got family or friends who could value it, if you just want to leave us a review, 5 stars would be lovely if you wouldn't mind on the Play or Apple Store or whatever store you're using, let you rate your podcast. If you could do that, that'd be wonderful because the more people who do that, the more people will find the podcast and get a sense of what it's about. And we know that people tend to follow people. So if you give them a good reason to listen, they will probably do it. If you're not loving the podcast, I'm assuming you still want to hear it at this point in the podcast, but feel free to let us know if there are things you want to see us change or do. We know, though, you love our mailbag episodes, so we'll come back and do one of those on Sunday. Until then, full on.
Cheers.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/listener. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691. Listener.